Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
My grandfather died when I was about 6.
This is the writer Roland Allen.
And many years later, when I was in my 20s, I found out that he had kept a diary for most of his life. And I was given 3 diaries from the years 1938, 1939, and 1940. Tiny, beautiful little things, smaller than an iPhone, fit in the palm of your hand. Terrible, tiny, tiny handwriting. So I didn't even look at them for a couple of years because they were just so hard to read. But then when I did, finally, I got used to his handwriting and I cracked it. And it really brought him to life. This man who my mother had really adored and who I'd never really known. And he became something of a character in my life. This is from May 1938. Wednesday the 11th. He says, "Suffer and bridge at Hofhaus with Thomas. Belly still on the blink." Thursday the 12th. "Saw Thomas off at 4 p.m. Then went to the office and went to bed." Friday the 13th, just 3 words, "stayed in bed." Saturday the 14th, "fed up, went to doctor at 9 o'clock, diagnosed appendicitis and recommended immediate operation at Jewish hospital. Fixed things up, I was operated on at 2:30 p.m. Now read on. The operation was not such a joke. Serious complications were present and I was in hospital for 6 weeks and 4 days. After which, there's a big gap of 6 weeks when he doesn't write anything in his diary, and he's evidently gone back for that last Saturday to describe the operation. It was a real striking moment for me when I realised that this man who I had the vaguest memories of was really bringing himself to life on the page. And even though he can have had no idea of who he was writing the diary for or who would ever read it, there I was, 70 years later, really getting into the nuts and bolts of his life. You know, nights out he had, the time his hat blew off his head into the river, the comings and goings of the various ships he was working with, getting drunk with sea captains, things like this. And it really brought him to life, I think, in a really moving, but also just generally positive way. Diaries, and in fact all kinds of notebooks, have a surprising power, given what simple, inconspicuous, easy to ignore objects they are. They are so basic, so cheap, so everywhere, and yet they can bring people completely to life again. And I guess one sort of paradox of these notebooks is the more boring a thing is when you write it down, the more fascinating it's likely to be 100 years later, 700 years later. So things like what you ate for breakfast, you know, for us, that's very boring information, but it's fascinating to know what someone in Renaissance Italy ate for breakfast because it's such a different experience to what we have. And I work for book publishers in London, so I was surrounded by creative people, by authors, designers, people with big ideas all the time. And I did notice that a lot of these people were really hooked on their notebooks. And I started to look and have a peek at what was inside. And it was always crazy stuff like spider diagrams or mad doodles or really sort of surprisingly formatted notes. And then sort of put these things together in my head. And the big question was, where does this come from? It's a very ordinary thing. It's so everyday that you don't actually ever see it. And when you start asking, well, where do notebooks come from? You realize that they must have been invented and therefore that there must have been a time without notebooks and therefore that they must have changed our lives in some way. And I guess that is the big question I set out to answer with the book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Roland Allen's book is called The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper. And in it, he does get to that question, the invention of the notebook, the development of paper. He explores the differences between writing something by hand and tapping that same information onto a screen. It turns out we process and retain information from a pen and paper better. The best part, though, may be the stories of the artists and thinkers and musicians and bureaucrats who kept notebooks. Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks are crazy. Darwin's may surprise you, and Marie Curie's are still radioactive. Roland Allen told us when he set out to write his book, he had to learn to embrace a new way of thinking.
I'm not a philosophical person. I get bored very quickly by philosophical questions, and honestly, I just don't grasp them. If you try and talk to me about the nature of knowledge or the nature of belief, then I will lose interest quite fast. But if you try and show me how a particular clock mechanism works or something like that, I'm a very willing audience. And obviously, I know this about myself. But what I couldn't get away from as I was working on the book was that there must have been something bigger, some kind of higher universal effects that the notebook has. And then I stumbled upon this philosophical paper from the 1990s.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of historical research. I read a lot of scholarly papers about different historical notebooks. I did not read any philosophy at all in the main research project of the book, but I stumbled upon this one paper, which was written by a pair of philosophers called Clark and Chalmers. And in it, they talk about a hypothetical notebook that belongs to a guy who's losing his memory.
Yeah.
And in order to remember things, he writes things down. They call him Otto, which is great because Otto is my son's name. So I enjoyed that. But they say, well, if Otto uses his notebook to remember everything, then surely that's part of his mind, in effect. And they tease this idea around and they knock it about. And they can't find any meaningful distinction between knowledge that Otto has on the page or beliefs that he holds on the page and beliefs that anyone else would hold in their mind. So they make the claim that your notebook is actually a part of your mind. It's just not inside your skull. And I think, and a lot of people think, that this is completely logical. In fact, when you think it through, it makes so much sense. The way that, you know, if you gave me your phone number right now, I would have to write it down to remember it. But that doesn't mean that I'm not involved with your phone number, you know. That doesn't mean that I don't want to remember it or that I would. It just happens to be a more reliable way than trying to do it in my head. And so, yeah, I do believe, philosophically speaking, that our minds and our beliefs extend out of the brain, outside the skull, and onto the pages that we work with, and also to an extent to our mobile phones and things like that in a different way.
But just the idea that writing a novel or doing scientific calculations, at least this is the idea here contained in the philosophy, is that they only became possible with help from the external, an external tool. So it's not just our minds. It's the actual process of using the implement that makes this happen. We're sharing this thing. That's what makes the notebook interesting to you.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And this is a big question. I'd love to know how people lived in medieval Europe, for instance, how a peasant lived who couldn't read or write, had nothing to read or write with, even if they could, but who never even saw books or saw them once a week from a distance when they went to church. You know, how they seem to be missing out on this huge realm of thought and of creativity, which is just completely, how to put this, it's completely everyday for us. It's completely unremarkable, that's the word.
Yeah.
But it was invented. It wasn't always in our lives.
Well, okay, put a pin in that idea for a moment, and I want to just mention something that will be deeply familiar for a lot of listeners right now, and that's their Moleskine notebook. The story of the Moleskine sort of comes up first thing in the book. It's about this woman named Maria Sebregondi, and she comes across this, I'll have you sort of take us through this, but she comes across these passages from a book by Bruce Chatwin, and in it are these references to these notebooks that he's using. And you say in the book that this meant something personal to her. Take it from there. Connect us to that story.
So a lot of people read Bruce Chatwin in the 80s, and I was one of them, and I loved him. Yeah. So Bruce Chatwin was this English author. He wrote travel books, which sort of skirted into fiction, really, because he was such an unreliable narrator of his own adventures.
Right.
And his biggest hit, which he wrote shortly before he died, or he published before he died, was called The Songlines.
Right.
It's a massive book about exploring Australia, basically, and ideas about nomadism. And this was a very exciting book in 1989, 1990. Loads of people read it, translated into every language, and people were very excited about it. And the last third of the book isn't a conventional narrative. It's just little chunks that Bruce Chatwin pulls out of his own notebooks. Mm-hmm. And it became obvious from these little bits and pieces, which were partly copied from elsewhere, partly just little vignettes from his travels, partly funny stories he'd heard, partly quotations from the classics or the Bible. It became clear that his notebooks must have been really fascinating, that he must have packed everything into them. And he talks about them as well, as how precious they were to him and so on. So I think a lot of people had the idea planted by Bruce Chatwin that a notebook could be something really exciting and really creative, and it became a sort of aspirational thing. And Maria Sebregondi's genius was to take it and turn it into a product, which is the moleskin.
Yeah.
And because she recognized those exact same notebooks as Bruce Chatwin used from her own youth. She'd used them as a student herself in Paris. So she knew exactly what he was driving at about the physical notebook. But she packaged it up. And as I said, I'm a sales guy. And I really appreciate, from a professional point of view, what an amazing job she did. Because she turned a really simple thing, which no one had ever spent any money on previously, into this aspirational, really quite expensive, glamorous,
preposterously expensive for what it is, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And the profit margins at Moleskine, the company, which has gone through many owners,
yeah,
the profit margins there are always ridiculous because they can mark up their product so much.
Yeah.
It's always one of the best, most profitable firms out there on the Italian stock exchange. And I love that, you know, how well she went about that. Just as a professional, I really admired it. But also, I don't want to be too cynical about it, because I think you and I and many, many other people who've really got good things from keeping notebooks creatively or from keeping diaries or sketchbooks or whatever, we do owe it to her, because she did get it out there in a way which no one else really had before.
So Maria Sebregondi, when she has this idea of developing the moleskin, she naturally heads to Italy. And let's explain why it's Italy, because this is, I mean, part of the book is what you describe as Europe's adventure with the notebook. And I guess that's the origin spot, like that's the epicenter is Italy. And why Italy of all places? Why is Italy the sort of the beginning part for at least the culture of the notebook you explore?
They were the early adopters.
Yeah.
So before them, you have the Islamic cultures sort of the caliphates, basically. So the capitals are places like Granada, Cordoba in Spain, Baghdad and Cairo in the east, and Fez in North Africa. And they were heavily into notebooks for hundreds of years before Europeans ever got their hands on them, really. And that does coincide with the Islamic Golden Age. But I don't speak Arabic, I don't speak Turkish, and this kind of area is horribly difficult to research. I'll leave it to someone else who's got the skills to do that.
Yeah.
But the European side of it is enough of a story. So the notebook comes into Europe in about the year 1250, and it's a result of sort of leakage from the Islamic empires because a Christian king, Jaume II of Catalonia, conquers a tiny town called Xativa in Spain, which is near Valencia on the Mediterranean coast. And it's famous for its paper. And that's why he wanted this small, otherwise unremarkable town. He spent years trying to besiege it and surround it and take it, because it made the best paper in the Mediterranean. And then, only then, once there is a paper manufacturer within Christian Europe, the Italians and then the French and the Germans and the English eventually can get into paper, and they buy into it. And the Italians are the first. So there was a real poetry when I sort of realized that Maria Sebregondi was responsible for the recent explosion in notebook use. It's a real nice historical echo going back sort of 600 years before, because it was the Italians who adopted it first. And the Italians back then, this is before the Renaissance.
Yeah.
They were famous across Europe for being the best merchants and the best money managers. And they used the notebook as technology, in effect. They used it as bookkeeping technology, as money managing, and as calculating on the hoof, but also of keeping accurate records which couldn't be forged. So if you had a business which kept its all of its business written down in a ledger, the boss could go away in the morning and come back in the afternoon having left the ledger in the hands of some subordinate, and he could be confident that they wouldn't have cooked the books, because with paper pages and ink, once it's down on the page, you can't change it. And this was the first time that there was a technology like that. So, of course, their business has become really big. They start doing things. I mean, all kind of financial things start at this moment. So banking starts in then. Companies start then. Limited liability partnerships start then. Interest becomes a thing. Compound interest, come to that.
And all of that is...
The Italians invented all of this.
Right. And all of that's connected to the fact that they could make notes on an indelible...
That's it.
Yeah.
That's absolutely it. And so you get this mad moment in Italy where they have this tech and no one else has it, and they become extremely rich as merchants and bankers. And it is very similar to Silicon Valley, a story we see 600 years later, where you have the Americans leading the world in computer technology, and American companies, you know, like the IBMs and later the Apples and Microsofts, absolutely taking over the world with this technology and churning through huge amounts of cash as they do. And the Italians were exactly the same. So for 100 years or so, the rest of Europe is just envying them this prowess. And then after that, everyone's sort of got their own notebooks and they're doing it the Italian way.
What's Zibaldone? Explain that.
So these businessmen, we mustn't think of anyone as being just one person, right? So these businessmen and bankers, they were also just regular guys who enjoyed the same stuff as we do. And so at the end of the day, having spent their noses in their ledgers all day long, they would go back home. And like us, they enjoyed literature, they enjoyed stories, they enjoyed poetry and songs and prayers and interesting tidbits from history. But because they had notebooks to hand, they could write them down and retain them. So you've got to remember, this is a time before printing. And if you wanted to have a book in your house at all, it had to be handwritten.
Yeah.
The idea that they could make these little anthologies for themselves is just wonderful. Mm. And the modern equivalent, I guess, would be the mixtape. You'll remember making mixtapes back in the 80s and 90s, right? Something which is completely unique. It's all of your favorite bits. It's every mixtape is a greatest hits, if you like. And Zibaldone liked that, you know. So they would write down their favorite bits of Dante's comedy. They would write down stories from Ovid. Aesop's fables were very popular, but they would also write down a meaningful prayer or some new ruling from the town's governors, which they had to abide by, a new tax or whatever, and they needed to bear in mind. So, and they wrote them down in these notebooks, which they kept at home, and they were called Zibaldone. And Zibaldone was Tuscan for salad, which perfectly gets sort of how tossed together they were, how random. They were made of loads of different things, and people loved them. But it seems to have been a peculiarly Florentine thing. So it really just happened in Florence. But it happened in Florence for about pushing 200 years. The young Leonardo da Vinci, for instance, definitely worked on Zibaldone when he was training as an artist, making Zibaldone for other people, or certainly in that workshop. He would have known all about them. And then he goes on to be the greatest notebooker ever, or one of the great notebookers.
Yeah. This sort of gets me to one of the insights of the book, and I guess it was something of a revelation for you, the fact that for all of those years that people are documenting prayers and personal information and recipes, I guess dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of years, in all of the collections of receipts and prayers, people were not in these notebooks revealing their inner lives?
No. And it's so surprising. I find it completely bizarre. And because these people did have inner lives just like us, and they had the same hopes, fears, doubts, anxieties, senses of humor, and they would write letters to each other all the time, which were very confessional, which talked about their emotions and their hopes, fears, dreams, etc. So it wasn't as if they couldn't put pen to paper and write about their emotions. They could. But they did not ever do it in a way which we would call a diary.
Yeah.
They never sat down and wrote a diary entry to themselves saying, I've had a terrible day, or I've had a wonderful day. It takes a few hundred years for this to happen. It actually happens bizarrely in England, because England at this point is a total backwater where nothing happens first.
Right.
But diary writing does seem to happen first in England. And then by about the year 1600, it seems to have become relatively, I don't know if it was popular, but it was certainly a known phenomenon.
But what do you make of that? I mean, there's this part, was it Magdalena von Schinn, who begins a journal, here I will be able to pour out my soul entirely. So at that point, they were revealing their inner lives. But why weren't they before? And it leads to another question that I wondered about, like, do we actually do that? In the sense that, are we honest with ourselves in these notebooks? Do we really reveal our inner selves? Or is it a sort of a creation of the person we want to be? Did you discover anything in working on the book about that?
I have no answer to that first question. Yeah. Why it happened to be England then, at that time, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, your second question, which is, are people honest with their diaries? I know Irving Finkel, who runs this project called the Great Diary Project in London, where they collect diaries. They have about 15,000 in there at the moment, and they're nearly all of ordinary people. So these are diaries which no one intends for publication. I think there's a big difference, or he certainly says there's a big difference between a politician's diary, which they write thinking that they're going to write their memoirs or publish it 20 years later,
right.
You know, Tony Blair or whoever, and an ordinary person's diary like yours or mine, who's can be pretty certain it's never going to be read by anyone who isn't a descendant.
Yeah.
And his theory is that everyone tells the truth in their diaries. Hmm. And he's quite definite about that. And I do, on reflection, believe it. I certainly don't ever lie into my diary. Now, I may be telling myself things I wish were true and they're wrong. I may be like slightly false in my views of myself or other people, but I'm certainly not being dishonest about it on the page. If I get things wrong, I'm getting them honestly wrong, if you know what I mean.
Right.
I think that people do tend to be, and I have thought about this, I think people do tend to be honest with their diaries. And certainly the diaries that I've read of other people, I tend to trust them. I tend to take them at face value.
You know, it's interesting you mention in the book how there were times when you were talking to people about the diaries they kept when they were teenagers. And whether or not they were honest with themselves in those diaries, they didn't want to share them with others. I think there was only one person who said, sure, you can have a look. What's going on there?
There is a real, and I think this goes back to the question of is your diary part of yourself? Is your notebook part of your soul? Hmm. There's a real sense of exposure and nakedness in reading someone's diary who's right in front of you. I mean, you really, you are stripping them. And a couple of times it's happened to me that people have read my diary when I wasn't expecting them to or didn't want them to. And I remember the sense of vulnerability and betrayal. And it is a taboo, I think, rightly a taboo, to read someone else's diary. Because you are getting the naked, unvarnished, completely honest version of them.
Roland Allen. We're talking about his book. It's The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of the notebook. Maybe it's easy to forget, but the notebook you use for sketching or doodling or journaling is a piece of technology that was invented. In his book, the writer Roland Allen tells that history, and he also tells the stories of the people whose notebooks shaped their work, like Darwin and Leonardo and Frida Kahlo. Allen also gets the question of why a notebook might be different or even better than that notes app on your phone. His book is called The Notebook, a history of thinking on paper. So we were talking about how this philosophy, this idea that a notebook is an external tool that contributes to the brain, the mind, to create something. And there's this great idea you explore in the book about the role of notebooks in the development of art. Now, it's a theory that you say makes sense to artists you've talked to, people who actually draw, but art historians are kind of skeptical about this idea. But I wanted you to talk about it. It's the idea that the notebook transformed the way an artist rendered the human portrait.
Yeah.
It happens in the last years of the 13th century. There are these two painters that you explain, illustrate all of this. Take us through this idea.
So this idea, I guess it comes from two initial realizations. So firstly, just to wind back a bit, I was a sales guy in a publishing company, still am. And a lot of the books we published back then were how to draw guides. So if you've ever bought a book on how to draw faces or how to draw places or drawing pretty patterns or calligraphy, anything like that, you know, I've worked on a ton of those books and I've met their authors. And they were the people who had interesting sketchbooks and notebooks we talked about earlier. All of them, any person who teaches drawing will tell you, keep a sketchbook, keep a sketchbook, always work in it, never stop, do it every day. That's how you get good at drawing. Okay, that's an interesting thought, just file it away. Then when I came to be researching the notebook and I realized that notebooks first popped up in Europe, in Italy, around the year 1300, I literally Googled what happened in Florence in the year 1300. And it popped up with painting. Giotto did such and such. Okay, Giotto, let's have a look at him. And then he realized that Giotto was the first Western artist, certainly since the Roman times, who could paint your picture and it looked like you. Before Giotto, for instance, we don't know what any popes actually looked like. So we have 1,000 years of popes, and no one knows what any of them actually looked like, except that they wore the funny popish hat, and they sat on a big throne, and they carried a crozier and made the popish gestures, because that's how portraiture worked in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, you drew a figure, and you gave it a sword and a crown if you wanted it to be a king, and you gave it a hat and a cross if you wanted it to be a pope,
yeah.
And everyone understood it, and that was fine. Giotto, after him, we know what all of the popes looked like because people have painted their portraits. So we know which ones were fat, which ones were thin, which ones were bald, which ones had dark hair, light hair, whatever. And that seems to me to be connected to this sketching. There's other evidence as well. But what we don't have, unfortunately, is any of Giotto's sketchbooks. We don't have The Smoking Gun, which says, well, in Florence at this time, they were learning how to draw with sketchbooks. And that's what gave them the skills to do things like realistic portraits or accurate perspective or creating a body which has mass and form and shape and the clothes draped properly. You know, all of the things that we look for when we're looking at a sort of realistic painting in the Western tradition and Renaissance painting in particular. So there is no smoking gun for that period. What we do have are the notes left by various artists who say that they were always walking around carrying notebooks and making sketches. And then later on, again, 100 or so years later, we have sketchbooks start to survive from about the time of Leonardo onwards.
I wanted to ask you about the all-time greats. we'll talk about Leonardo. He seemed like the all-time great notebook keeper, but we should mention Bob Graham, Senator Bob Graham.
Oh, it's completely irrelevant whether or not he was for the sake of your listeners, let's not say if he was a Republican or a Democrat.
Okay,
or not.
Great,
you need more politicians like Bob Graham. We all do.
Explain why. He was incredible with his notebooks.
He was a Florida politician, and yep. He was a farmer until, I don't know, his 40s. And he wanted to become governor, and he couldn't get the party nomination that he needed. This is going back to the late 70s. But he didn't give up. So he had this great idea for meeting people and getting people aware of him and creating this constant stream of news stories about him and his candidacy. And the way he did it was to work 100 jobs in Florida. So he worked on fishing boats, calling nets. He bussed tables. He worked as in the hat check room in nightclubs. He carried suitcases in hotels, and he worked on building sites, and he went out with the police on night shifts and so on. And he quickly realized that he was meeting so many people on these jaunts or these days of hard work, because he actually did always put in a shift, and hearing so many stories about how people lived that he just had to be writing it down all the time. So he started keeping these diaries, which were very detailed about this madcap scheme of his to work 100 different jobs. Anyway, he worked 100 different jobs, and he became very well known in Florida as a result. And everyone saw that he was a serious, decent, hardworking person. And he won election to governor. And then later, subsequently, he was elected senator. And he never broke through fully on the national stage. But obviously, he had a very excellent political career for many years. But the notebook bug bit him really badly during this period. So he started very compulsively keeping a log of his entire day, starting with getting up in the morning and brushing his teeth. He would write that down. Woke up at 7:09, yeah. Brushed my teeth at 7:15, ate my cereal at 7:25, you know, got in the car at 7:46, all of this stuff. Huge detail. He would fill notebook after notebook, I mean, thousands, these tiny little wire-bound notebooks. But this turned into a terrific resource for him as a politician, because every time he met someone on the street, for instance, when he was just out shaking hands and kissing babies, he would pass them his notebook and say, write down your name, write down your address. And then they would get a letter, and they would tell their neighbors that they'd had a letter from Senator Graham. And, you know, you can imagine how effective this was pre-internet at kind of getting the word out about him. I mean, it's very successful. By all accounts, he was a very efficient governor and senator who was always on top of the issues, had a very well-organized office, who were very good at getting laws passed and the sort of the nuts and bolts of government. But his problem was that in Florida, everyone agreed to this. On the national stage, they just thought that he was mental because he was constantly writing things down, you know. And every 5 minutes, he would stop and whip out his notebook. And so a couple of times, he sort of went for presidential nominations or vice presidential nominations. And every time the story would come out, there would be a couple of TV stories about it, about how Bob Graham is the guy who's just always writing stuff down. And it would just be considered too odd for the national stage. So he never broke through as a national politician, which I think is a shame. But he seems to have been a very, very decent guy. He's still actually alive, I believe. But now pretty aged. And his notebooks have all been archived, and they make this amazing resource, because it is literally every minute in the life of a United States senator, and historians of the future are going to love that.
But it does raise the question of how much is too much?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, people at the time described it as obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, I agree that it's obsessive and compulsive, but it did him no harm. So is it a disorder?
Yeah.
And I don't know. That's an open question. There are lots of things I do because I feel I have to, which other people don't do, and you're the same yourself. If they don't affect our lives in a negative way, what of it, you know?
It's interesting because this brings us to oddly, to Leonardo da Vinci. One thing you mentioned is that someone did the math and that he filled his notebooks at a rate of about 1,000 pages a year. Martin Kemp, art historian, said he was never at rest. He spent something like how many hours did he spend a day writing? You mentioned this in the book, and it made me wonder how, if you are an artist or someone extraordinarily gifted like Leonardo, you know, an engineer, a great thinker, what's the right equation between the actual writing about the thing and the doing of the thing? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, firstly, just to put that in a bit of context, some of Leonardo's notebooks are these incredible, huge pages covered in writing, covered in fine drawings and diagrams, and they're very complicated, and you think, wow, that's a lot of work. Yeah. Okay. Many of them are also tiny. and just consist of tiny little sketches and tiny little observations. So it's not so hard then to think about him filling 3 pages a day, if you consider that some of them were just very small things that he sketched as he was going about his day. The thing is, Leonardo is often described as an engineer, but very little of what he designed was ever built.
Right.
He's described quite rightly as a great painter, but he finished, I think it's like 19 paintings in quite a long career, something like that. He was not very productive. He's described as a great anatomist, but he never published a book about it, a great color theorist, and he was all those things. But basically, Leonardo's job day-to-day was being Leonardo, because he was employed by patrons. You know, the King of France would give him a sum of money in order to hang around the court being a genius, conspicuously being a genius. And before that, it was the Duke of Milan, and before that, it was, probably one of the Borgias in Florence. Leonardo was a very public genius, and he showed it off with his notebooks. A big function of the notebooks was as Leonardo's public portfolio, when he would show off his schemes for building a flying machine or some fortifications for a new town or a new port or a scheme to drain swamps. None of these things ever happened. None of these machines were really ever built, so far as we can tell. And yet he made a living out of showing off the diagrams, which were incredible and amazing. And he made a living by showing off these paintings, which were incredible, but never, ever got finished. You know, the worst thing in the world was paying Leonardo to paint your portrait. And then he would still be at it literally 20 years later. The Mona Lisa was in her teens, I think, or certainly very young when he first painted her, or when she sat for the portrait. When he died, it was unfinished and she was in her 30s. So he was a terrible, terrible person. As a freelancer, he was awful. But he was genius at being Leonardo. So, yeah, the notebooks, I think, were in part this sort of public projection of stuff which he'd thought of, which was incredible, but which didn't really need to happen.
Roland Allen, his book is called The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Roland Allen. We're talking about his book, The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper.
There's a great story you tell in the book. I wanted to have you talk about the, as the chapter heading puts it, the long life of LHD-244, this tiny notebook, 118 pages, second half of the 15th century, it emerges. It's a lovely story. Talk about this, would you?
So this is, we're back in Italy again. These are contemporaries of Leonardo, but over a very long period. So this is a tiny, tiny notebook, and it's full of little musical tips and tricks and short musical sketches and formulas for things like how to transpose music from one key to another, for instance, or how to sight read music. So it's not a musical manuscript, if you like, in the sense that it doesn't have all of the notes for a big piece of music, but it's the kind of notebook which a music teacher must have used. But what's fascinating is that it's in multiple different handwritings, and it's filled up over what seems to have been generations. And they've placed it basically, I think quite confidently, to a monastery near Bologna in Italy. And it seems as though the head of music at this monastery, who would be tasked with teaching the monks how to sing their offices and the psalms and so on, would use this notebook to teach them how to sight read music or how to transpose something into a different key. And then he would get old and die. His successor as the music teacher would pick up the same notebook, add a little bit, refine it, have some new musical fashions, because musical fashions were always changing at this time, and then would grow old and die, and he would pass it down. But it's weird because it's this very, very humble notebook. It's not at all grand. It has no intrinsic value. It would have been so easy for any of these people to have just copied it all out again in a notebook which wasn't a falling apart. No one ever did.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of the sentimental value which attached to it, that as it went down through generation after generation of these monks who had, you know, very spiritual lives, but also, music must have been hugely important to them. And this book where all of them learned music and then taught music using the same little notebook, it must have become so precious to them over the years.
Which I imagine you could relate to in the sense of your grandfather's diaries. You say at the end of the book that those diaries that you have in boxes, those will be the things that you rescue if your place ever catches on fire.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And it's quite a dramatic image. I honestly don't want my place to burn down. But yeah, I mean, a friend of mine was, an American friend was caught up in the Palisades fire recently, and he really did have to load absolutely, he had 10 minutes to load up his van and drive. And it made me think, whoa, this does actually happen to some people. And in my case, I would definitely have slung my diaries and my grandfather's diaries into the van and then probably stopped, because nothing else is remotely as precious as those. I mean, I've got lots of things which I really care for. But, you know, once I've got those in, I'd feel I'd be able to relax a little bit. Yeah, they're definitely a part of me, which I would hate to lose. And the idea of losing that connection to my grandfather is too painful to think about. Mm. Can I just make an illustration? Why they're so precious? Because this isn't in the book. So I've got two kids. One of them's 13, one of them's 21. And the 21-year-old recently asked me, how did I react when you told me that I was getting a little brother or sister? Because she was 7 at the time.
Yeah.
Sort of peak little girl, wants a baby, you know, sibling age. And I was able to go back to my diaries and tell her the conversations that she and I had had over a course of 3 or 4 days when me and her mum were telling her the news that she was going to have a little baby brother. I'd forgotten them totally. She'd obviously forgotten them totally. And yet they were there. You know, that is priceless. Being able to go back to that moment, which is, I would say it's a memory that is so precious, but evidently I'd forgotten it completely. But it was still there in my diary. And that's really why I keep a diary now, because you never know what is going to happen next, which you're really going to want to re-experience again in 15 years' time or whatever it was. And, you know, my daughter was practically in tears hearing how she'd reacted. It was a beautiful moment. So that's why they're precious.
Mm. What's the difference, though, Roland Allen, between you grabbing your iPhone and writing in the notebook app of your phone that the story of your finding out your daughter is born? What's the difference between that and opening a notebook and taking a pen and writing that same information? Like, what's the difference between those two experiences?
I guess it's similar to, imagine that you need something to drink your coffee out of. You break the last mug in the house. So you can go down to Walmart and you can get the cheapest coffee mug on sale at Walmart, whatever it is, $1.59. Go home, drink your coffee. It works perfectly well.
Yeah.
Or you can go to a pottery and you can by hand yourself get the clay, mold it, shape it, let it dry, glaze it, bake it, make something which is completely unique, completely personal to you, that you've made with your hands, which isn't industrial at all, which has got your fingerprints literally all over it, and take that mug home and drink your coffee out of that.
Mm.
That's a different experience. Now, the coffee's the same, if you like. The life experiences are the same. But then I would venture that it's a richer experience drinking coffee from a mug that you've fired yourself. And it's similar. Once you fill the notebook with your own handwriting, it becomes so personal, but it also becomes this physical thing which you get active pleasure from handling. And I don't think that ever happens with an iPhone.
You asked this question in the book about whether the notebook's physical constraints in some kind of paradoxical way make it more useful than an unlimited device, that the constraint can be useful. Say something about that.
Yeah. I think creativity really thrives if you give it a constraint. If you say, for instance, if you look at the classic pop song, 1960s, 70s, or 50s, come to that, they had to be 3 minutes long because that was as long as a 7-inch record could be, a 45 could be.
Yeah.
So it was pointless doing something which was 6 minutes long because no one would ever hear the second half of it. So you have the Beatles and Elvis and everyone doing something which is really tight, which is really exciting, and it's over in 3 minutes, and then invent this art form which is bang, 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 3 minutes, that's it. Because they have to, and they've got no choice. And I think that rock and roll and that music really gains from that 3 minute energy. So I think that's an example of a constraint being a good thing. Another, you read a book, for instance, you read any novel, I mean, and you create a picture in your mind, you know, you have your picture of Hogwarts or of the Tudor court in Wolf Hall or whatever it is you're reading. You don't need the illustrations. You create that picture in your mind when you're reading the book. And that limitation of just having words to play with, I think, gives you a really vivid relationship with the text, which you don't necessarily gain, you know, which isn't, rather, adding pictures doesn't necessarily make that more intense, might do for some people. But for me, I think it slightly diminishes it in a way. And I think it's the same thing with writing on paper, that it's, you're forced to be brief. You're forced, because it's quite hard work writing, to be, you know, to value each word that you put down. I mean, my diary, I think quite carefully about what I write before I start the sentence. Whereas if you're typing, very commonly when I'm typing, I don't know how my sentence is going to end. So I go back and I delete and delete and backspace and retype. And then, you know, finally version 3 is the sentence, and that's fine. Doing that by hand is just exhausting. And you end up with something really ugly. So the constraint of writing an ink on paper forces you, I think, to think through what you want to say before you start putting pencil to paper or pen to paper. And that's a good discipline.
Let me ask you, finally, I want to come back to that idea developed by the English philosophers, you know, the idea about the extended mind, that our minds aren't just in the brain, that they extend out of the body and in the physical world. And one of the things you mentioned, that thought experiment that they conceived involving that created person Otto, and
Otto's notebook, yeah.
Yeah, Otto's notebook. But you say in the book toward the end that you want to create your own thought experiment, and instead of looking into the future, which they do, these philosophers, you want to look backwards in time. Do you mind taking us through that experiment and explaining what you're hoping to learn from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole book is an attempt to understand what the notebook's done for us.
Yeah.
And I think part of that, we have to make the imaginative leap and think, well, where would we be if we didn't have a notebook to write in? And you have, it's such a, I mean, it's so far from our current experience. You really have to sort of think your way back into the shoes of the medieval peasants, or of the tribes person in a rainforest, or roaming the prairie with nothing to write down in and nothing to write down with. Does that leave you with nothing, no thoughts to write down? What sort of thoughts does it leave you with? You know, obviously you sing songs and you have dances and you tell stories to each other, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very, very different kind of experience, but it's also one in which you can't, for instance, engage seriously with mathematics, or I don't see how you could engage with mathematics, which is the sort of the building blocks of the universe. And you would have a hard time recording histories or keeping accounts or dealing with large numbers of things, you know, animals or crops or anything. You would have a really hard time designing a building or making a map. And just thinking how much richer our lives are now because we can do all of those things, even though we happen to now do all of those things with computers and iPhones and so on. For hundreds of years, the notebook was the only way to do it. I was talking to someone who works on a tech blog, and he said, well, now in the digital age. And I said, whoa, 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 hold up. In many ways, this is still the notebook age, because we live in a capitalist era. Capitalism is definitely the fruit of all of those Italian bankers coming up with things like companies and limited liability partnerships and futures trading and shares and interest rates, you know. That all depended on the notebook. For hundreds of years, our societies ran on notebooks of all kinds, every institution you care to think of, governments, hospitals, prisons, whatever. it's only very recently in human history that we've moved away from doing everything in the notebook to suddenly doing everything on a computer. And I think, you know, we should be a little bit grateful for that, that notebooks have been around while we've been alive in order to give us that richer experience, I think.
Roland Allen, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. This conversation has been a real pleasure.
Roland Allen, his book is called The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.